This week, David Mitchell's best-selling novel, The Bone Clocks, is on our minds. Mitchell is a literary virtuoso, best known for his 2004 novel, Cloud Atlas. He writes these intricate novels. They weave together multiple narrators, interconnected stories, even different genres, all within one book. So now he's done it again with The Bone Clocks. It veers from the story of a young runaway girl to a cosmic battle between two groups of immortal beings. Steve Paulson asked him to read a passage from the beginning of the novel, narrated by the book's main character, young Holly Sykes.
I was 7 years old in 1976. I heard voices in my head. Not mad or drooly or especially scary even, at least not at first. The radio people, I called them, because at first I thought there was a radio on in the next room. Only there never was a radio on in the next room. I knew hearing voices wasn't normal, but they weren't actually harming me, so maybe it was just one of those secrets people live with. One night, I had a nightmare about killer bees loose in the Captain Marlowe, and I woke up in a sweat. A lady was sat at the end of my bed saying, "Don't worry, Holly, it's all right." And I said, "Thanks, Mum, because who else could it be?" Then I heard Mum laughing in the kitchen down the corridor. That was how I knew I'd only dreamt the lady on my bed, and I switched on the light to prove it. And sure enough, nobody was there. "Don't be afraid," said the lady, "but I'm as real as you are." I didn't scream or freak out. I mean, sure, I was shaking, but even in my fear, I felt it was like a puzzle or a test. There was nobody in my room, but someone was speaking to me. So, as calm as I could, I asked the lady if she was a ghost. "Not a ghost," said the lady who wasn't there, "but a visitor to your mind." I asked what my visitor's name was. "Miss Constantine," she said. Then she was gone. It took me ages to fall asleep, but by the time I did, I sort of felt I'd made a friend.
Oh, that is great. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And it turns out Miss Constantine is not exactly a friend.
No. She's a double or treble or quadruple kind of an agent. But yeah.
Now, David, how would you describe your main character, Holly Sykes? And this is the voice of the young Holly Sykes we've just heard. And how she figures into the narrative structure of this book?
Well, she's a complex kid. She's 15, pretty solidly working class. Her parents run a pub. And I hope she's likable. She's tough. And she's really the linking device between all of the six parts of my novel. She's the narrator in both the first and the last section, and also she's a major character in the lives of the narrators of the other sections.
So your book spans decades, and these various sections are narrated by different characters with their own very distinctive voices, and you seem to be playing with different kinds of stories, even different genres. And I have to say, the whole thing is pretty dazzling. And
thank you.
You like playing with genres, don't you?
Yes. I mean, if I was pricklier than I am, then I might try to modify the verb play. Genre is what my novels need to deploy to be the novel that I want to write. So throughout the book, we have social realism in the 1980s in a section I just read from, but we also have something steeped in the opposite end of the social spectrum, one of entitlement and money and privilege. We have war reporting, and we have satire and pastiche, then we have the fantastic, and then at the end we have a kind of dystopian, steeped novella to close with.
So why do you like doing that, putting all of this together in the same book, these very different styles?
I guess because I'm an omnivore, and I like to write novels that pull the rug out from under the reader's expectations. I like that being done to me when I'm a reader, if it makes sense, if it's not just stupid or done as a gimmick. I like to be surprised by favorite writers.
Now, as you've said, there are different kinds of styles that you're using here. I mean, there's one, the first section, it's kind of a sort of a story about teenage love and angst. There's another section about sort of student life in Cambridge University. And then there is also this more fantastical part, which kind of runs throughout the story, really a cosmic supernatural battle between the forces of good and evil. Why did you want to incorporate that into the story?
By looking at immortality, it licenses me to think about mortality. Now, I could have done that by setting the whole thing in a care home, or write a classic midlife crisis novel about someone who notices he's getting older and, as a response to that, buys a sports car, obtains an inappropriate mistress, and runs for office. But there were already books like that out there, and some are really good, but that just wasn't what was floating my boat. I wanted to look at this thorny topic about how to develop a saner relationship with ageing, and I tried to do that by putting at the heart of the novel this Faustian pact and this question, really. If you could cheat death, if you could retain the youth and health and squanderable bank account of days and time that you have in your 20s, what would you be willing to pay for that? Would you be willing to amputate your conscience, for example, if that deal cost innocent people their souls or their lives? Would you be willing to fake your death every 10, 15 years and leave behind your family and everyone you love before people start to notice you're not getting any older? Now, this is a sort of fantastical way to look at issues about mortality, but it's what I wanted to do. As it happens, I hope it makes a page-turning narrative. I hope it's fresh and original.
There's a lot of, I guess, what I would call paranormal stuff that's happening here. I mean, there's sort of a whole cosmology that you develop. I mean, there are people with psychic abilities. They hear voices and channel other spirit beings. There are telepathic, even precognitive abilities. People can sort of predict the future. And I'm wondering, is this just all good literary fun, or do you take these ideas seriously at all?
It's mostly good literary fun, but the world's a mysterious place and the laws of physics are not written in concrete. They have cracks, and the next generation of scientists explore these cracks, and there's cracks in those theories as well. And the generation after explores those cracks and finds newer, deeper, more underlying laws of physics in the nature of matter and the nature of mind. So I wouldn't rule out anything that I've written either.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Have you had any experiences like this? I mean, what we would classify as paranormal experiences, you know, uncanny coincidences, clairvoyant dreams, that kind of thing.
Nothing that I wouldn't put down to possible coincidence, except one visit from a ghost when I was living in Japan, aged about 26 or so. That was fairly... I can't really rationalize that away.
Can you tell us what happened?
I was just woken up in the middle of the night by a very strong presence standing at the end of my bed that wanted to know what I was doing in that house. So I was wide awake and not as calm as I'm making this sound. But eventually I explained what I was doing there, and the presence didn't go, but I felt that it had accepted my explanation, and I was allowed to go back to sleep, so I did, and that was it. That was it. How about you? Have you ever had anything like that?
I have not, at least things that I can sort of explain away, but I have people close to me who have.
Yeah. There's a lot of it about. Most of it sort of, I think, is explicable within a scientific or psychiatric paradigm, but even the sort of the edges of these paradigms are not clear-cut, and they get hazy. And this sort of meshes quite well with what the novel is. The novel is this sort of big, baggy form where inexactitude and the inchoate can thrive and prosper and be turned into and used by narrative.
Well, there's one thing I'm curious about. The Bone Clocks has gotten a huge amount of praise and acclaim, but there's also been a common refrain among certain critics who wish you just give up the magic and, you know, stick to the real world characters and plots. What do you make of that criticism?
It's not my job to think about it that much. I mean, I'm a novelist, and this book needed this fantastical element in. I didn't have any choice. It wouldn't have been the book I wanted to write had I exorcised it of the places where the laws of the natural world are bent. This is what the book needed to be, so this is how I wrote it. So, kind of, why not? Almost, who cares? I mean, surely what matters is the book any good or not? And why can't literary novels contain elements of the fantastical? What about The Master and Margarita, written by Mikhail Bulgakov, set in, I think, 1930s Stalinist Moscow, where we have a talking cat, where the devil comes to Moscow to hold a once-in-a-century banquet, where Jesus Christ and Pontius Pilate meet and converse. It's a brilliant, brilliant novel. And does everything have to read like a late Henry James novel for it to be any good? Really? What about Midnight's Children? What about 100 Years of Solitude? Maybe I nailed my true colours to the mast more visibly than I meant to then, but kind of come on is how I feel, you know.
That's David Mitchell making the case for the fantastic in fiction. He's talking with Steve Paulson. Mitchell is the author of Cloud Atlas, and he's just come out with a brand new novel called The Bone Clocks.